And he should certainly know, based on the experience of Rwanda, which, of course, 20 years ago had its genocide of 1 million
people. I need a question too, please.
The question is this. Now, they are an example of a political solution being locally developed, solving the endemic causes of the problem that led to the civil conflict.
Yeah. This is not a question. Get
it
to
is,
the point.
It is. But a million people had to die in the process.
Yeah, that's not a question either. Please.
So my question, if you allow me, my question is this. Do you support, therefore, and do you see it's inevitable that the similar number of people, if necessary, must die in this conflict in order to arrive at that same political solution?
Right. Thank you. John Redwood.
No, of course I don't think it's necessary that a certain number of people die. What I'm saying is it's beyond the reach and the effectiveness of my country, the United Kingdom, to be able to stop those deaths. And it's very difficult to see how us deciding that we want to kill some people there is going to shorten the period of killing or hasten the political solution, which is the only final solution that will create a peaceful outcome. 100 years on from the Great War in Europe, we should remember a little humility about this, because there was mass destruction, there was a very comprehensive military victory, there was a complete mess on the diplomacy and the politics. We had to do it all over again 20 years later. And doesn't that tell you that the politics matters greatly, and there is no theoretical limit to the amount of killing if you can't get the politics to work?
So is it your view that this should just be allowed to run its course, whatever the humanitarian cost, as it did in Rwanda? Is that your view?
No, that's not my view, but my view is very clear. I do not see how the UK can stop the violence or make a useful intervention that could create a peace or a set of democracies. We tried
that.
We failed.
Intervention is not a magic wand. I mean, a lot of people are talking about it as though there's a decision, do we use this wand or not? But actually, the wand doesn't work. We can't do that.
It should run its course.
Well, I don't want it to run its course.
I want
some leadership and some discussion and some cooperation emerging in this very troubled region. But it's not in my gift to create that.
Douglas Murray.
Could I just very quickly, a couple of people have talked about, would there be any situation where you can imagine the British people wanting to intervene in some way? Remember, intervention might have all sorts of causes, but let me put two out there that haven't really come up. One, that is a perfectly legitimate one, is revenge. Now, the Prime Minister, after the latest decapitation on video of a British citizen, went out and said, wherever these people are, wherever they are in the world, we're going to hunt them down. And that is balls. Absolute balls. And anyone who knows about the situation there knows that it's a facile boast and demonstrates a desire which is not fulfilled by the overreach and the incapability we actually have in that region now. So I wish that politicians didn't use that kind of rhetoric, but it is a completely legitimate thing. Why shouldn't people in this country, as I've heard many people say in recent weeks, say we want revenge on ISIS for doing that to our citizens? Why isn't that a legitimate reason to go and do something? And secondly, and nobody's particularly mentioned this tonight, so it'll come down to me to do it. Why wouldn't it potentially be the case at some point that this country, historically a Christian country, might take some interest in the cleansing from an entire region of Christians?
All right. Let that hang in here. Yes, sir.
Hello, I'll direct this at Patrick. It seems to me that nothing unites Muslims more than the issue of Israel, and that surely there was an injustice that was done there, and that if we are really going to bring Muslims together, we've got to try and deal with that issue, and that maybe we should sort of see ourselves as Judeo-Christians and just deal with issues within Judeo-Christianity and leave Islamic issues to the Muslims.
Wrong assumption. Wrong assumption on Muslims.
Patrick?
Wrong assumption.
Well, I think, you know, the whole Syria and Iraq now, you've got a whole four or five confrontations that have, crises that have all come together, including that between Israel and its neighbours, between Israel and the Palestinians. I think you have to, they all exacerbate each other. It would be good if you try to de-escalate these crises. It's very difficult to do. It's like the 30 Years' War in the 17th century in Germany. There are now so many players with so many different agendas that it's very difficult to bring to an end, because there will always be some who see some benefit in continuing to fight. But that the 30 years war did eventually end. That you need, but that's the direction you need to go, not how to win wars. Ed Hussein was talking about people who'd, you know, like to go back, they'd like Assad to go away, but Assad controls, there are 14 provincial capitals in Syria, he controls 13 of them. So when America and Britain say at negotiations that we had in Geneva earlier in the year, the only thing worth talking about is transition from Assad, in fact, this is a recipe for continuing the war. And although they didn't mean this, this is also a recipe for creating conditions in which ISIS, the Islamic State, flourishes. That's the direction you need to go.
I would also like to point out at this stage that the gentlemen against the motion haven't yet outlined what this Western strategy is supposed to involve. Obama admitted that he didn't have one, so I'd be curious to know what they have in mind. And also, I think we need to get away from the simplistic argument about the Western being damned if they do intervene, damned if they don't. There are favourable arguments to Western intervention, to what campaign, and I'm not disputing the strategic, the advantages of Western intervention, but you have to have a long-term plan. And at the moment, the West doesn't have. It's not just a matter of having a short, sharp military shock, which can have some result on the short term, like taking out dictators or...
No, you've made the point. Douglas Murray.
Can I quickly address that? The biggest fallacy which has fallen apart of our time in international affairs is one most of us heard for most of our adult lives, which is that Israel-Palestine was the key to the region. And that if you got an agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, everything else, the whole region would, you know, Yemen's economy would boom, Saudi would be governed by the Liberal Democrats. You know, it's nonsense. When the Arab Spring began, people did not come out on the streets asking for a settlement about East Jerusalem. They were asking for the basic right to have a say in their own futures. That's what they care about. The whole paradigm through which this country's politicians and thinkers have gone is completely wrong. Let me explain, however, there is a different paradigm, which I would argue we should adopt. In May this year, Boko Haram was stealing hundreds of Christian schoolchildren. In July, Hamas started its war against the Jewish state again. In August and July, ISIS are going against the Yazidis and the Christians. The problem is not that you can solve all the problems of the region by Israel-Palestine. No, the problem is that the region has a massive problem, which is radical Islam.
A short word on Israel and Palestine.
You've had you say it. I'm going to ask him a question. Nabila wanted to know... No, excuse me, I'm not talking to you. That's fine, apology accepted. Just don't do it again. Nabila wanted to know, what would intervention look like? Quite. What is the plan? Exactly. What is the strategy?
I don't have the answer to that. I say the motion is that intervention itself, that this country can do no good in the region. I am saying if you decide what your strategies and your priorities are, then you decide what you do as a result. But you don't decide there is nothing that this country can possibly do in a region.
Let's have some more. We're counting the votes, but I want to get a few more in, and standing up doesn't help you. The lady in the middle there, please. Lady in the middle, keep your hand up there. And there's a gentleman there. If you shout at the panel, you'll just be disqualified. Yes.
This is to the four side, mainly John Redwood and Patrick.
You need to speak up a little bit, please.
Sorry. This is for the four side, mainly John Redwood and Patrick Cockburn.
Okay.
But you talk about having a ceasefire, and you talk about flying the white dove and having peace, but I think you're forgetting that ISIS hate us, and a lot of people in Syria and Iraq really hate us. People in our own country are going there because they hate us. How on earth are we supposed to go to these people? Everyone needs a ceasefire. We aren't their ruler. We aren't. We need to go in and help them on the ground, if anything, because that's who it's affecting.
Okay, I've got that. Who's going to broker a ceasefire? Why would ISIS, which seems to think it's winning anyway, why would it agree to a ceasefire?
Well, we have to look at our options. We just heard that our opponents want us to intervene, but they have no idea how we should intervene, and they have no idea why we should intervene.
You misheard.
Surely one needs to answer those two fundamental questions.
We're happy to.
The ISIS forces, as they are, as I understand it, are deeply embedded in villages and towns. It is not a field army that you can go and attack or bomb from the air. and they evict people from their flats and their homes, and they live alongside people that you do not wish to kill. So it's extremely difficult, which is why so many of our missions come back with the bombs unused, because all you would
do is... But what the woman wanted to know is, how would you broker a ceasefire?
Well, I can't broker a ceasefire. I've been extremely honest throughout this debate, saying that I do not think it is in the United Kingdom's gift to do
so
this.
So both sides tonight are bereft of any sensible suggestions?
No, that's not just, at all. That's not true.
I've come up with a very sensible suggestion.
No. Andrew,
the very sensible suggestion I've come up with is that we should not go and make it worse, that sometimes you have to accept that things are beyond your power.
Indeed.
And I'm absolutely amazed that Douglas Murray, in an earlier intervention against me, said that basically what you've got to do is go and kill every one of these ISIS people and then we will have a success. Well, first of all, you may end up enabling them to recruit a lot more. Some of them will go before you manage to kill them. And as I understand it, as he said that about 500 of them, on his estimate, were living in the United Kingdom, they were the children of United Kingdom citizens, he has a very differential morality. He's presumably not suggesting that we send the British Army round to the houses of these people and shoot them before they go to the Middle East. But apparently, once they've gone to the Middle East, we should send our army out there, a much greater risk, to shoot them there.
Since when did we decide... There's obviously a problem in the transmission of my words to your ears.
So, what did you say?
But let me just put one other thing out. Since when did it become the agreement of so many people that bombs, when dropped on people from a very large height, can do no good? In 2004, an American citizen was beheaded by Abu Muzaffar al-Zarqawi in Iraq. A few months later, two 500-pound bombs were dropped on Abu Muzaffar al-Zarqawi's head. That did a lot of good. It would be a good thing if we got people like the people who were beheading our own citizens. I think it's a desirable objective. I'm not telling you how you do it, but I do think, among other things, since you wanted a strategic point, I do think, among other things, it's deeply unwise to go into... It's deeply unwise to go into any conflict telling your opponents what you're not going to do. That's what this country and America now do. We go into conflicts and we say we will not do boots on the ground so you can disperse into a civilian population because we'll make it easier for you. We'll tell you in advance what our plans are. I think that's not a good idea. There's an idea for you.
All right. Gentlemen, who else is... who's got the microphone? You've got one there. Let's have another hand over. There's a gentleman there in the blue... I think it's a blue jacket. Yes.
First of all, should we not take Hippocrates' advice and make sure that first we do no harm?
Exactly. But whose advice?
Hippocrates, I think.
Oh,
the doctor,
very well.
The ancient doctor. But secondly, can I...
Was he Sunni or Shia?
I'm not sure. The second thing is that I personally suspect that cold fusion and the prospect of unlimited energy supply is being suppressed and might well happen soon. If that did and we didn't have to pay the Middle East for their oil, to what extent would that deflate the problem?
All right. Well, I'm going to let that hang in there for the moment. You should come to our energy conference on December, first Monday of December, and you may learn a few things about that. I should point out that the United States now gets virtually none of its oil from the Middle East. When Mr. Obama leaves the White House in 2016, it will be 0% hydrocarbons released from America. Not Europe, but America. Who's got the microphone? Yes.
Yes, I was just amazed, from the pro side, especially John Redwood, an experienced politician, advocating sitting back and doing nothing and waiting for them to sit down in a circle and talk peace when all they want to do is grab territory, otherwise they'll behead people. It's a naive argument, really. But my question for Lord Danner, really. Strategically, haven't we almost got to use, the enemy of our enemy as our friend? What about Assad and Syria? Because, the minute we start attacking them, and they'll just go back over the border to Syria, really. So strategically, what would you do if you were the Prime Minister, really?
All right, thank you for that. Is President Assad our ally or our enemy now?
Just to deal with that very narrowly, there are aspects of him, our enemy's enemy is our friend as far as that's concerned, and it relates almost primarily to operating aircraft in Syrian air defence space. Their integrated air defence system is pretty capable, and a couple of months ago when I said I thought we should have a conversation with him, either above or below the counter, it was really to enable us to operate in their airspace. But I will continue. It's been suggested outrageously on the other side that there is no strategy. The strategic objective is the destruction of Islamic State and the destruction of ISIL, which I said in my main speech, we should discredit them on the way. It was also said, quite ridiculously, because it's been corrected since by Nabila, that Obama said we have no strategy. That comment predated the NATO summit a month ago, when a coalition was put together of about 20-plus nations. The intention is to change the terms of battle from the air, it should be done in Iraq and Syria, to arm local forces on the ground so that they can at least defend their territory and maybe protect their people, and meet in slightly slower time, raise a force that can conduct an offensive operation. If it can't be done satisfactorily by local forces, it may have to be done by Western intervention forces. And that's what's got to be done to destroy ISIL and to destroy Islamic State.
But the so-called allies have provided very little help.
Could you answer the question which our member of the audience asked you? Is Mr. Assad now in this struggle our ally or our enemy?
Mr. Assad is relevant to us in terms of the integrated air defence system. I've made that point already. Actually, he doesn't control a large amount of the territory that's currently in dispute. Assad can be put to one side for the time being. The pressing issue is to deal with Islamic State and ISIL. We can deal with Assad in Geneva 3, 4, 5 or 6 in 3, 4 or 5 years to come.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to leave it there. We've overrun, but then it was a very emotional and interesting debate. Just before I give you the result, you see on the back of the programmes, we've got an evening with Neil McGregor. I'm sure many of you have heard on BBC Radio 4 and his new series. He did the History of the World in 100 Objects. He's now doing History of Germany in a similar way, and he's doing a night on the 10th of November. If you leave your cards or emails on the way out, you stand a chance of winning a couple of tickets to come to this event. And if you don't win, you can always pay up. It isn't going to cost very much. And he's a wonderful speaker. And also just to remind you, because I'm afraid we're heading to that time of year, the Spectator's wonderful Christmas carol service. There's also details there on the back as well. Thank you all, before I give the result, for turning up tonight. You've been a most engaged audience. I think we've had a very spirited debate and covered a lot of ground. This is now the result. The motion, Iraq and Syria are lost causes, Western intervention can't help. I just remind you, on the way in, 4 was 83, against 64, and 139 don't knows. Now, after you've listened, for the motion, 123, against the motion, 216, only 24 don't knows. The motion is defeated. The debate is won by those who oppose the motion. Many thanks again to Brew and Dolphin for making these evenings possible. Thanks to the wonderful Spectators events team. Before you go and have a safe journey home, one final round of applause for our excellent debaters.